everybody. This is Courtney. I just wanted to let you know before we get started that all the music today is from Jimmy's time in China with Sambasia Beijing. So enjoy that, and thanks for listening. Welcome to the Brazilian Beat, where we are getting to know the Brazilian percussion making community one interview at a time. This is Courtney.
And I'm Diana. How are you, Courtney?
I'm good.
What's going on tonight?
We have Jimmy on the line.
Woo! Jimmy Biala! Hey, Jimmy.
Get too excited.
Jimmy is our good friend from the Bay Area, and we're really happy to have him finally on our podcast. Welcome, Jimmy.
Yes, happy to be here. Happy to be here.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Well, if you don't know Jimmy, he's a professional music educator, performing and recording artist. He's an assistant director for Mestre Jorge Alabe's Grupo Sambojillo Bateria in Oakland, California, that is, and an accompanist for percussion and dance classes at the California Brazil Camp, where many of us have met Jimmy. He also performs regularly, playing Latin percussion and drum set with different ensembles in the Bay Area. Jimmy founded the group Sambasia in San Francisco in 2002 and Sambasia Beijing, now called Templo do Samba, in 2006. Currently, Jimmy is a director of the ensemble Bloco do Sol, based in San Jose, California. And we're ready to talk with you, Jimmy.
All right. I'm ready.
Awesome.
Good.
So, Jimmy, tell us how you got started playing music. Like, what was your first exposure to music?
My first exposure to music was in elementary school, actually, and very interesting experience. There was a music teacher that came by one day to school and asked us if we had any interest in playing a music instrument. So we had to sign up, and then we had an appointment with my dad to go and meet with him. And he had all these instruments set up in a room. And so he asked me if any of the instruments looked interesting, and they all looked interesting to me. And but my dad, you know, because I have asthma, I've had really bad asthma since I was very young. Oh. And so he said, well, none of these instruments like the saxophone or the trumpet would work because that might be bad for his asthma. So somehow or another, I got a violin. And so I was taking violin lessons for not very long, really. And my best friend across the street in our neighborhood, I would go over to his house, and I saw him one day playing with the drumsticks on a practice pad. And I said, oh, what's that? And he said, oh, it's my practice pad. And I'm learning how to play drums. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Can I want to try it. So he gave me the drumsticks, and I started to play around on the drum pad. And, you know, I said, oh, I'm learning the violin. And he says, oh, I want to try that. So I brought over the violin, and so we traded.
The old switcheroo.
Nice.
So my friend Carl kept the violin, and I kept the practice pad and the drumsticks, and we never switched back.
And is he still playing the violin?
I believe so. The last time I talked to him, he was still playing music. And
that's awesome.
About 2 years after we had switched, my father took me to the music store to get my first snare drum.
Aww.
Yeah, big day, big day. So that was very exciting. And about a year after that, I He bought me a cymbal, and then eventually in middle school, I got my first drum set.
Awesome.
So where did you grow up? Was this all in California?
Yeah, this is all here in the South Bay. I was born in San Francisco, but I grew up in the South Bay.
Go Giants.
Santa Clara Valley. Yes, go Giants. Yeah. And yeah, I played drum set through high school. Although when I got to high school, I played in the band program freshman in high school, and I had a really grumpy band teacher. He was really kind of old grumpy guy. And at that time in high school, you would go to line up and sign up for your classes at the beginning of school. Well, at the beginning of my sophomore year, I decided not to take the band program. And he saw me walking around signing up for the other classes. And he said, why aren't you signing up for band? And I said, oh, I'm not going to do band this year. I'm gonna do other things. And so he said something really awful to me. He said, if you don't sign up for my band class, you won't continue to play music. And I just thought that was the worst thing anybody could ever say. And so
terrible.
The thing is that my best friend at the time, he and I would practice drum set all the time. And so as soon as school was finished, I'd ride my bike over to his house and we'd both play drum set. I brought over my drum set and so we'd practice, and that was plenty for me. I just, you know, I wanted to be in the music program, but I didn't want to have anything to do with him, the teacher.
Right.
So in my junior year, I switched high schools and I got involved in a band program. It was marching band and concert band. I was much happier there. And then in my senior year, I was doing a play. I was playing a percussion in a play. And then that music teacher from the first high school I went to, he went to that play.
Oh.
And then afterwards he came up to me and he said, hey, that was really great. He says, that was, you know, the music was awesome. And he said, you know, I owe you an apology. And he apologized for saying what he did to me.
Wow.
That's great.
He remembered. He remembered. And so pretty funny.
So you played all throughout high school?
Played all throughout high school. And then after high school, I continued to play drum set. I played in some different bands. And I ended up playing, you know, some jazz drum set and a lot of rock drum set. And I ended up playing in a couple of bands. Eventually, I made my way into playing with a top 40 band. And at
Jimmy,
that time,
can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Did you ever have a ponytail?
No, I never had a ponytail.
Okay, good. Good to hear. I'm glad.
Never had a ponytail. Yeah. However, there was, let's see, this had to be in the early 80s, I'm sure it was.
Was there a mullet? Was there a mullet involved?
No, but my hair was dyed. I dyed my hair for a music video. I was in a band that was shooting a music video. And I dyed my hair blue. So I had blue hair for a while. Yeah.
Does this music video exist?
Yeah, I want to see
Can
this video.
Can we get our hands on that?
It's a long story.
On the interwebs?
It was a video that was being done for the MTV Basement Tapes, actually. And I signed a waiver while the video was being done. And it turns out that I signed a waiver saying that they could cut up the video and use parts of it for whatever they wanted to. And I don't think that video ever ended up going anywhere, except there was a shot of me that ended up being used in a wrestling commercial. So I had some buddies in Southern California call me. They said, hey, you're on TV down here a lot. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, they would see you playing drums. And it's like a split screen with this like crazy wrestler guy and then you playing drum set with your blue hair. So, but I never got to see that. I, I, I always wanted to see that clip, but I never got to see it.
Listeners, if any of you have access to this clip,
you had VCRs in the 80s and you recorded a lot of wrestling, give us a call.
Yeah. Wrestling.
We
commercial.
Want this clip.
Great.
Oh, my goodness.
And that, yeah, so I played a lot of rock music, and I, yeah, at that time, I had a day job making pretty good money, but I was playing a lot at night. I was playing, you know, at least four nights a week, a lot here in San Jose. And I did that for a while, and I really got burnt out on it, actually. I wasn't really happy with my playing, and whether it was, you know, rock music or whether it was jazz music. And so I took a break and I called it quits for a while. I stopped taking gigs, and I got tired of my day gig too. And I ended up getting into bike riding. So I was in a bike shop one day, and they had some great music playing in the bike shop. And I said, oh, I knew this music. And the manager of the shop and I became good friends, and he said, hey, you know, what do you do for work? And I said, well, I help with purchasing for a restaurant company. He said, well, we're looking for someone to do purchasing here at the store. And so I quit my job and I went to work in a bike shop. And, you know, I went from making really good money to very bad money. And I wasn't playing music, and all my friends and my family thought I'd gone insane. So, but it was great. It gave me the time to kind of reset. And so I was racing bicycles. I was still listening to music, but I wasn't playing it. And then an opportunity came for me to get back with some musicians playing, but in a acoustic setting. So rather than with electric guitars and bass and a big drum set, they wanted to play acoustic. And so they asked me if I, you know, played any percussion, and I said, not really, but, you know, I can try. And so I went to the music store and started looking at all the percussion instruments, which for me was a new experience, because I would usually go into a music store and go right to the drum sets and start looking at all the gear, but now I started looking at all the percussion instruments. And so I figured, well, let me take a look at the congas. And so I decided, okay, well, I'll try this. And, you know, I asked if I could take some lessons at the store, and turns out that I knew the teacher there, but he was more of a drum set teacher. And so I learned some things from him, but after a while, I was thinking, no, this can't be right, because my hands hurt too much. And then I heard about a lecture series about Cuban music history that was being done by John Santos up in San Francisco. And I decided to go to that, and it was amazing. I loved going up there. And the lecturer, it was a series of lectures, and I really learned a lot. And then I asked him, I said, well, do you teach private lessons? And he said, no, I'm too busy these days to take any students, but I'll be happy to refer you to a couple of teachers. And one of those teachers was Mike Spiro.
Oh,
wow.
And so that's how I met Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was 1990. And so I started studying with Michael, and that was a great experience. He really, Michael remains, you know, one of my mentors in life, and he's opened a lot of doors for me beyond music.
Mm-hmm.
And but musically, they were just studying with him in his basement there of his house. I learned a lot, and I took private lessons, and then I went to some ensemble classes, and eventually I made my way to Cuba, and I met some of the folks that he had studied with, and learned rumba, and I even studied dance while I was there. It's about 20 years ago.
Wow.
So anyway, that led me on a certain path. But while I would go to Michael's, I would be playing, and then he had this big pandero hanging on a nail on the ceiling, like off one of the rafters. And I asked him, I said, "What is that?" And he says, "Be careful what you ask."
Totally sounds like a Mr. Spyro.
Yeah. So he told me, "Well, that's a Brazilian instrument." And once in a while, if I didn't have enough bread to pay for lessons, we would do an exchange. So I would like straighten out Michael's garage for him, help organize his garage. And in the process of doing that, I would come over across all of these other instruments, and he's got to have more cuicas than anybody I know. So I started asking him about the names of these different instruments. And at the same time, I started to play with the Latin Jazz Ensemble at San Jose State. And the teacher there, Dan Sabanovich, I played in his Latin Jazz Ensemble, but then he was also teaching a class in Brazilian music. So I started taking that class, and he showed me his pandeiro, and to give me a few pointers on how to play it. And so for a while there, I was kind of going back and forth. I was playing Latin Jazz Ensemble and playing rumba. And then also I started getting really interested in Brazilian percussion. And so that's how I kind of got back into music.
At that point, had Spyro been studying with Georgie yet?
Not quite yet.
Oh, okay.
This had all transpired probably early to mid 90s. I'm not sure at what point Michael had met Georgie. It might have been during that time, or maybe even before. Yeah, I didn't meet Georgie until I think it was 1999, mm-hmm. in San Francisco.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's funny how a lot of our podcast interviewees intersect as far as, when they met Georgie, when they started studying Georgie, when they started studying with each other and all that. So it's really great to hear.
Yeah.
All this history.
Oh, yeah. And, Bataketu came out. I had also had the opportunity to go to these summer intensives that were produced by the California State University system. And that's where I met Mark Lamson.
Mm.
And they had these great summer percussion programs that I would go to at every opportunity, where they had teachers like, Michael would teach Cuban music, and then Mark was teaching Brazilian music. C.K. Ladzepko was teaching Ghanaian music. And all in the same day, you would have 2 hours of instruction in each of these.
Wow.
It was really awesome.
That sounds awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, the first one of those that I went to was in 1993, and Chalo Eduardo was teaching at that time.
Wow.
For that session. So I would say, as far as like spending just kind of an intensive amount of time with percussion learning, that was my first, I think it was a week or maybe a 2 week intensive, up in Humboldt, at CSU Humboldt.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And I continued to go to these summer arts programs all the way until 2004. But it
were
was
you playing with a group at this time, in addition to taking the lessons and learning? Was there
No, I wasn't playing with any group. Hmm. Yeah, I played my first carnival in San Francisco in 1995 with a group, and that was my first exposure to carnival in San Francisco. But it was an okay experience. I knew it wasn't something I was going to return to until I had learned a little bit more about how to play and about the music. So I waited before I went back to Carnival. I didn't end up playing again in Carnival until I had my own group in 2003 with Sambeja San Francisco.
Okay, so let's get the timeline worked out then. So first you were taking lessons. Well, yeah, you were taking lessons with all these different people and going around and learning in lots of workshops and things. And then, but you were still playing in like a jazz group or something? Or no, you weren't playing in any groups at all?
Those gigs that I took were playing like jazz drum set now and again.
Gotcha.
And then playing some of the, the acoustic rock music.
Gotcha.
That kind of got me back into playing music. So I was playing gigs here and there, but that wasn't my main focus. I was studying a lot, which I really enjoyed. And the program at, I was really lucky at that time at San Jose State, they had an amazing music program. So I was there, two or three times a week playing Cuban music, Brazilian music, playing in the Ghanaian ensemble. And so those teachers to this day, I stay in touch with, and they continue to be important influences to me.
So, gotcha.
Yeah. And let's see, I think it was 1999 or around there when Georgie had visited San Francisco. Rudy and Josephine had brought him there to do some percussion workshops. And so that's where I met Georgie first. And then I didn't meet him again until the following year was my first year at Brazil Camp, 2000.
Did you go to the first year?
No. That was either the third or fourth year of Brazil Camp already, because I think Brazil Camp started in 1997.
Because it is the 20th anniversary this year,
Yes. Yeah.
Shout out to Rich and Dennis, Brazil Camp.
Yeah. So that going to Brazil Camp for the first time, that was the, I don't even know if that I would call that a new chapter. I would say that was a whole new book for me. But so it was really, that's where my, I would say that's where like my real journey with Brazilian music started. And I had gone to Brazil my first time in 1999, actually.
Hmm. And that with a group or with on your own?
No, I was invited by a colleague of mine that was studying at the New School in New York. And he came out to California to study with one of the teachers at San Jose State, who was a great drum set teacher. And his name is Royal Hartigan. And Royal was asking students in the classroom if they could host anybody who was coming out to study with him. And he asked me, and I said, well, I don't know, I'll have to check with my wife. And he said, oh, I think you would really like him. His name's Gustavo. He's from Rio de Janeiro. And I said, yes, he can stay with me. So Gustavo and I had a great time. He was in California for a couple of weeks, and I ended up going to New York to visit with him there. And he said, you're coming to Brazil. I want you to meet my family, and I want you to come out there and have a good time. So the day after Christmas, 1999, was it 1999? Yeah, I left for Brazil, and I spent New Year's Eve there, and I think I spent about 3 weeks there in Rio with Gustavo. And Gustavo was a great musician. He's a great musician, and really had some friends in some of the samba schools. So he was a big fan of Mangueira. So Mangueira was the very first samba school that I ever saw in Rio. And it was like You know, you go into their quadra and it's just like this green and pink heaven. And so that was amazing. And
that must have been an incredible experience.
We went there at every opportunity. Yeah, we'd stay there all night for the rehearsal and go to the beach in the morning. And
so at that point, Jimmy, what were you playing bateria wise?
I was playing tambourine, and I was playing a little bit of surdu, but again, I wasn't associated with any group at that time. Mm-hmm. So really the only regular Brazilian instrument I would be playing would be in whatever was available at the class at the university. And then after that first trip to Brazil, I decided that I really wanted to learn seriously. Mm-hmm. And so I called up Mark Lamson, and I decided I would make these one-day trips to San Diego and just spend the whole day with him. So he would say, okay, just let me know when you're coming. So we I'd go down there, he'd pick me up, spend all day at his house learning, and then I'd fly back that night.
Wow.
And man, I learned so much from him. So much. And so he was really my first like full-time Brazilian percussion teacher. And then when Georgie moved to the Bay Area, of course, I started spending more time with Georgie at that time. But most of everything, you know, that, as far as my development and my learning and Brazilian music has come from my experiences with all of the amazing teachers at Brazil Camp. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah, I think going on 17 years now.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time learning before actually joining a group, it sounds like.
I did. I mean, I was able to start up Sambeja in San Francisco, and I got a grant in 2002, and so that fall, I opened up classes. In 2003, we did our first carnival.
Now, how did you come up with, I mean, how did you come up with that focus for Sambeja? How did you mix the cultures? What was the impetus for that?
I was teaching conga classes, actually, at the Japanese Community and Cultural Center of San Francisco. As I lived in San Francisco at the time, and I moved up there in 2000, and I was looking for how to get, you know, kind of break into scene teaching and playing, and so a friend of mine, she recommended the Japanese Cultural Center, and they were very open to it, and so I started some classes there, and one weekend I went by there. I think I was going by there to pick up some drums or something, and the taiko drumming classes were happening. So I sat there and I listened to those drums, and man, it was just amazing sound. And the sound of the taiko drums reminded me of when I had gone to Mangueira and heard the bateria. Mm. And so I was thinking, wow, this would be awesome to play Brazilian music with the taiko drummers. And so I decided to go ahead and write up a grant proposal to the California Arts Council with this idea in mind to bring an ensemble of you know, Brazilian percussion and Japanese taiko drummers to the carnival in San Francisco. And so they awarded me with the grant, and the Japanese Cultural Center matched the funds and donated the space. So for almost 6 months, I was able to offer free classes.
Wow.
So I had a big attendance of people that came. And yeah, so that first year that Sambeja participated in the carnival, we had about 50 people in the bateria, and then on this really long flatbed truck, there were 12 huge taiko drums.
Oh, cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we had a guy from Hawaii who was teaching Hawaiian music at the Japanese Cultural Center, who spoke fluent Portuguese. So he composed an Enheidu. It was really quite something. So we had an Enheidu, we had the taiko drummers going, we had our bateria behind this big, huge flatbed truck, and yeah, it was awesome.
Can I ask you, what was the Enheidu theme?
Oh, God.
Digging back.
It was something about announcing here we are and building cultural bridges. I think that was the theme.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, of our parade that year.
Very cool.
So, yeah, and that ended up going into... We ended up doing different things. Each year we were in Carnival. One year we mixed maracatu with Korean folk music, which was really great. And another year we mixed samba hege with some traditional Japanese songs.
Wow.
And so during that time, there was... I think it was 2004, there were some people visiting San Francisco from Taiwan, and they noticed our contingent. And so later we were in touch, and they were looking for people to go to Taiwan to participate in the production of a parade, which is called the Dream Parade. It's a big community parade that happens in Taipei every year around October. So that was in 2005. And on my way to Taiwan, a friend of mine who lived in Beijing at the time said, well, if you're going to be going to Taiwan, please come to Beijing first. So I went to Beijing first, and I did a performance there with a dancer from Korea. And after the performance, there was a guy that came up and asked me if I taught private lessons. And I said, well, I do. I don't have much time here, but we can get together. And that person was Xiao Yong, who is now the director of Templo du Samba.
Manu!
Yeah, oh. Yeah, Manu. Yeah.
Shout out to Manu. And.
Yeah, and so that's how we met. Then I went to Taiwan and did the parade thing, and I had such a great time there. I also had a great time in Beijing. And after that first parade in Taiwan, I ended up going back to help them with the New Year's Eve party, and then I moved there. I really fell in love with the place. So I moved
with
there.
With Beijing?
In Taiwan.
In Taiwan, okay.
So I was in Taiwan for almost 2 years teaching Brazilian percussion to different tribes of Taiwanese Aboriginal people.
Wow.
So that
this was... What year was this?
This was 2005 to 2007.
Wow.
And then after that project finished, I was thinking about moving back to California, but then my friend mentioned that, you know, I should think about moving to Beijing. I went to Beijing, and Xiaoyong, he talked to me and he said, here, you're not going to have any trouble finding students. So if you decide you want to teach classes here, I will start getting people together. And so... Yeah, sure enough, I decided, okay. So I moved there and started off with like maybe, you know, 10 to 15 people. And maybe not even a month or two later, there was double that amount.
Oh, my God. So backing up a little, I mean, were you freaked out at all? Like, Oh my God, I'm moving to Beijing. Am I really moving to Beijing?
Well,
I mean, did you have any hesitance about doing this?
No, I didn't because, I had the support of my friend who was very encouraging, and I really became very good friends. I became very close with the students and made some very good friends there who, you know, I really miss a lot, and I continue to visit when I can. I was just there this year in the spring to be part of their 10-year celebration because the Temple of Dasamba.
That's crazy.
So, we had a big 10-year party, celebration party, and it's really wonderful. So, yeah, moving overseas, it was a big risk, but at the same time, I felt I was ready for it. And
big adventure.
And, it was a big adventure. I learned a lot from my time in Taiwan and from my time in Beijing.
How are your language skills there?
Terrible. 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 Yeah. Taiwan was very difficult because, you would speak Chinese there, but then each of the Aboriginal tribes have their own language. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult. So I would start to learn a few words here and there, then go to a different village and, it'd be completely different language. Although everybody speaks Chinese, but when you go into the village, many people are speaking their Aboriginal language.
And were you teaching kids, adults, everything?
Mostly kids. Mostly kids. Yeah. So when I went back to Taipei, where, my apartment was, where I was based, I was teaching mostly adults. But then whenever I went into the village, Aboriginal villages or areas, those are mostly school kids. So it could be elementary school, middle school, some high school. Yeah, it was really an amazing experience.
How are your student, like your adult students in Taiwan and in China? Were they, am I going to get followed by the Chinese embassy for saying that they're different? your adult students, were they,
was it difficult?
What was that like? Yeah, was it different than teaching here?
Well, I mean, anytime there's, I think, genuine interest in learning something,
right,
especially something that's unusual, I guess you would call it, to the folks in Taiwan and in Beijing, they really loved it a lot. And so the thing is here, teachers struggle to find students, and there isn't any problem with that in Taiwan or Beijing. So I didn't have to go out trying to recruit students. There were many students that wanted to study. And so it was great. And in Beijing, we had so many students. At one point, we had to have, I believe, three or four levels of classes.
Wow.
So we had classes, I think, 2 to 3 days a week.
And so when you were there, was this interest in Brazilian music just getting started, or were there other things happening like capoeira or music, jazz, or anything like that that was going on?
I in Beijing at that time, the punk rock scene was, and heavy metal. That's where it was a big, music draw in Beijing, was punk music and heavy metal rock. And so what's interesting is the place, one of the places where we had classes is actually a punk rock music club. and our agreement was, we could keep our drums there and have classes there. We had access pretty much any time the club wasn't being used, but every month we had to produce a concert. And so we would just use the proceeds from that concert to, we would have some kind of a split of the door But our group was very popular at the time, and so we had no problem bringing in an audience.
And how were you dealing with instruments? Were instruments readily available?
No.
Or did you bring a lot?
I brought some, but the first instruments that the group, the first time we had like a class and performances, like students were bringing parts of drum sets. So it was a mishmash of drums. But then there was an instrument company in Taiwan that had started making instruments for the students that I was teaching in Taiwan. So my colleague in Beijing came to Taiwan and he had a meeting with the instrument company. And then one of the students in Beijing invested money into the group to be able to bring instruments from Taiwan to to Beijing. Yeah. So, and at that time, the instrument maker in Taiwan didn't make any instruments, any drums out of metal. He made mostly wooden drums. So all of our surdus and hepinikis and kashas were all wooden. Yeah, so now, you know, Manu is producing some of the group's instruments in China, and he's also bringing in instruments from Brazil as well.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
So you were there in Beijing for how long again?
About 3 years.
Wow.
2007 to 2010. I moved back to California February of 2010. Yeah, I wasn't sure how long I was going to stay in Beijing. It was difficult for me to leave, but at the same time, I missed my family and I needed to be. I think I needed to be playing more back with Grupo Hio,
mm-hmm.
and being back here with Georgie and Michael, and yeah, I needed to get back. So
when you went to Asia, you left Samba Asia here in the States. Did that keep on going?
It did. My good friend Masaru Koga, he directed the group until I think their last carnival was 2011.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved back to California, he asked me if I would take the group back over again, but I told him no because I wanted to take a break from directing any group, and I wanted to, I needed a break from it. Mm-hmm. And plus, I wasn't planning on moving back to San Francisco. I decided to stay in San Jose because there was work here in San Jose waiting for me, teaching in schools. So
before you had left, you were playing with Georgie Alabe's group?
I was playing with Grupo Hio before I left. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, I was playing, I was teaching my classes in San Francisco on Sundays, and so after some Beijing classes were finished, then I would cross the bridge and go over to Georgie's classes in the late afternoon.
In Oakland? Oakland? Is that where he was teaching?
Oakland, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yeah. And then I would say, I don't know, maybe it was like maybe about a year or two after I had moved back, I was teaching classes at the Mexican Heritage Plaza here in San Jose, and there were some opportunities to do some community performances, and I was teaching a small group Brazilian percussion, and so I decided, okay, let's do a few of these community events, and that's how Bloco do Sol was born.
Gotcha.
And Bloco do Sol is composed of all ages, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So we have a very it's very different generations of students, which is great. I really enjoy that a lot. And so I teach many students during the academic school year. I see almost 400 young
wow.
students a week.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And so if, when those programs finish in the spring, a lot of the students have interest in continuing to play. And so I usually conduct a summer program. This year I might actually have two summer programs. And so out of those programs, I have the kids start practicing with the adult group, and then our performing window is usually around late July into August. Yeah.
And so your group plays strictly samba, right? No samba reggae or anything like that?
Actually, we're playing mostly samba reggae.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so most of the rhythms we play are Bayou rhythms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We're just starting to get a little bit into playing samba. But I'm, you know, with this group, what's really nice is I just take my time with everything. And we go at our own pace. And I'm in, you know, there's no, I'm in no hurry to do performances or things like that. Those performances come our way, and it's like, okay, you guys want to do it? And if we're ready, then we'll do it.
And you did have some kind of high-profile ones last year, didn't you?
This year we opened for Sergio Mendez at the San Jose Jazz Festival.
Nice.
So awesome. That was really fun. Yeah. It was very short. We did a little processional through the audience that was at the main stage. And then when we got in front of the main stage, we turned around and played for a little while. And yeah, it was great. The audience was really fun. And so this is our second year at the Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm. And Dennis has been very supportive of our group. He really enjoys it a lot.
That Dennis.
Yeah, Dennis. Yeah, and Bola of Bola Percussion plays in our group.
From Bola from where?
From Bola Percussion. He plays in our group also.
What does he play?
Let's see. These days he's playing agogo. He's playing a little bit of kasha. And yeah. So
he's not one of your dancers, is he?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah,
I want to make sure. So, Jimmy, how do you? You've got this big group. How many people are in it?
Well, let's see. I would say, like right now, our classes have anywhere from 10 to maybe 15 people. We have Saturday morning classes, mm-hmm. and then in the summer, it's bigger because that's when the mm-hmm. kids are out of school and they join for those classes. So. It can be anywhere. We can be up to 30, maybe 40 people.
Wow. So how does that work with direction? Do you have section leaders? Do you have somebody helping you out doing different things? You
see,
have
I
a
have
very
my,
lovely wife.
I knew you were going to ask me that question. So I have in my notes here in big, bold letters, me.
And who else?
Me. So, yes, Yuko helps me, but as far as like, you know, doing all of the, I guess what you might call the admin stuff and all mm-hmm. of that, or decisions rather, that's pretty much just me. And, but yeah, Yuko helps me, of course. And so we're trying to move things along as far as having some dancers and some drummers and having our own little kind of thing here in the South Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. And how do you work the instrumentation? Like, do people audition? Is it just like, how do you do that?
No, I might have one class where I rotate people around. Sometimes we show up Saturday morning, we get the room ready, I put all the instruments on, and I just say, okay, everyone pick one. And we go from there. And or sometimes if we're getting ready for a performance, people will already know what instrument they're best suited for. But a lot of times I will tell people, just pick one and, you know, I'm going to watch you play, and then I would try to evaluate what instrument you might be best suited for. So, and then from there, we see how well the rhythms come together, and we take our time, and eventually, magically, it does come together, and everyone's pretty comfortable and having fun, and enjoying being part of something, you know, special.
I love that you mix the kids and the adults together. That's
really cool. No, that's great. I think that's, you know, because the kids, a lot of times, the kids will pick up stuff really fast, and so that puts pressure on the adults.
Sure.
So yeah, it's very cool. I really like that a lot, and the kids keep it fun because, you know, the thing with, like, our group is we're having a good time. We're doing our best to play the music well, and I won't play any music in a public forum if it's not right. We want to do a good job and play the music respectfully, and make it powerful and have good energy.
I love that.
Awesome. Yeah.
So, do you charge for these classes, like to pay for the space, or how are you working that out?
Yeah, we charge a fee for the class. So we have like on Saturdays we have a percussion class usually at 10 o'clock, and depending on how we structure it, it'll be like hour and a half percussion, and then Yuko's dance class will be right after that.
Oh, cool.
This month we tried something different. And so we had 1 hour percussion and 1 hour dance, but the fee was for both classes. So I encourage everyone who's playing percussion in the first hour to stay. Most everyone did, and then take dance class after.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. Yeah. So, and that was really fun. I think we're gonna, it was kind of an experiment. And I think it worked. People had a good time. So we'll see if we can extend that. And then those dancers that have been coming, a few of them for Yuko's dance class, they come in. And it's good. It's good. So it's very exciting.
So for those kids groups, you said you had 400 students. First of all, how do you remember all those names? And second of all, do you have instruments for them?
Yes, I've over the last couple of years, when I first moved back, I had pretty much one set of instruments that I was taking to each school. Uh-huh. So, and then my shoulder and my back said, nope, that's got to stop. So I started investing in sets of instruments. And do you guys remember Memo Azevedo from Brazil Camp?
Of course.
Yeah. So Memo, when I first met him, he was working at LP. Right. And LP was kind enough. He was really supportive in helping me get an endorsement with LP. And so, I'm able to get like agogo bells and all kinds of stuff from LP to help me, the kashas and things like that I use for all my school programs. So now I have enough gear for to keep at those three school sites. it's a lot of stuff.
It is. But,
So yeah, but it's great because it's been a slow process making that investment. But it's worth it. It's worth it. And then I use a lot of that gear for my summer programs. And so.
Gotcha. Do you have like a giant truck or minivan or something?
I have a minivan. So I'm I'm an expert at fitting drums into a minivan. So, as far as space, it's we don't keep all the stuff where we live. Some of it is at my sister, some of it is at the Mexican Heritage Plaza where we teach our weekend classes. And like right now, especially at the schools where I'm there all year, I just keep the gear there. So that works out really well. Drummers, you know, they have a lot of gear.
Got a lot of stuff.
Yeah, don't I?
A lot of stuff. So, but yeah, it's you know, it's great.
So, how do you have any issues with? Are the kids? I assume the kids are really into it and they really want to practice. Do they practice at home, or how do you motivate them to practice?
Fear.
You're so scary, Jimmy.
Yes, I'm
corporal
very scary.
Punishment.
No, they do. They practice, actually. I mean, you know, those kids that are making the, you know, especially because their parents have to bring them. And so, you know, the parents are very supportive. And so they says, oh, yeah, you know, they really enjoy it a lot. And they're always practicing. They're always playing on something. And,
oh, that's good.
And so, yeah, most of, I mean, you know, it's one of those things where the kids come because they really enjoy it a lot. And so, and, you know, during the school year, I teach all those classes during the school day, which is great. And so, but, the, you know, the classes are like 30 to 35 kids. And so I might be at the school all day teaching. And, you know, that's different because some of the kids that are like, most of the kids are into it, but there's always going to be a few that are like, nah.
So is this an optional thing that they can do, or do they have to take music and the music?
Well, if their teachers decide to participate in the program, then it's like a regular class for them. Mm. Although we're not meeting every day. We meet once a week.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, they have to be there. So
nice. What about you, Jimmy? When do you practice? When do you find time to practice with all this activity?
During the holidays. During the holidays.
You've been like doing this week.
Yeah, I played some congas today. It's very fun. I just got just found some really cool vintage congas. I think it was last week or the week before. And so I've been playing those every day. I've been enjoying that. And I get some time to practice. Usually, a lot of the practice will involve preparing for a performance or preparing for something I want to teach, something like that.
Do you have practice tips for our listeners?
Practice tips?
Yeah.
Well, I think metronome, that's always nice to take advantage of. But also, I think, you know, practice is not limited to just, you know, playing the instrument. I think if you're studying a music seriously, then listening is a big part of the practice. So,
And I think even the language too, like with all this Brazilian stuff, I mean.
Yes, definitely.
We all pick it up at some point.
Well.
Or most of us.
We try to. I'm trying, although it's funny, I knew all of these different words and phrases in different languages, but, you know, can't really put any type of sentence together. Or I end up mixing up the languages, you know, it's really funny.
You speak Bialys?
Yes, Bialys.
Bialy.
But yeah, I tried to learn Chinese when I was there in Taiwan. And then when I would go to Beijing, my students in Beijing would say, oh, no, we don't say that here in Beijing, you know, don't speak Chinese like that. It sounds terrible. And then I would go back to Taiwan to teach, and my Taiwanese students would say, oh, no, don't, you know, your pronunciation is awful. You sound like you're from Beijing, you know. And it's like, well, because I live there. You know? So that was very interesting, going back and forth between Taiwan and Beijing and hearing the comments that way. So, but yes, I've made some attempt at improving my Portuguese language skills to no avail. So I got to keep trying,
Well, it seems like you're always kind of the right-hand man, like to Jonas, like you were Jonas's right-hand man, one of them. this year. So you kind of have to be on top of what he's saying if you can.
Yes.
Curtis.
Yes.
Shout out to Curtis.
Yes.
Woo, Curtis.
Yeah, Curtis. Man, this year for me was really, it was great. I always have a wonderful time at Brazil Camp, but this year being asked to be like an assistant role with to Curtis and to Mr. Jonas was really a great experience. And so, yeah, we had such a great time together.
Yeah, it was really, really fun. You
know, yeah, in and out of class. So,
yeah.
Really great time. So I'm looking forward to seeing him again in the coming year.
He's great.
And I wish I got to see Curtis more often too. You know, that here we're so lucky in the Bay Area because Georgie lives here. And so I get to hang out with Georgie pretty regularly. But I wish I could see Curtis more often. That would really be something. So
come to the West Coast, Curtis.
Yeah. I went out there one summer to visit him in New Orleans. And it was great. It was great. Really nice.
Didn't he come here for Carnival last year?
Yes. Yeah. He comes every so often. And what was nice this year, Carol came out also.
Nice.
Yeah. She's awesome. She's great. Great teacher. Nice. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it's the learning continues. And so
always.
I'm very fortunate to continue my learning and keep that going forward.
Is there anything new that you're learning? You're working
anything
on?
New?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I guess I kind of, you know, with helping Georgie with Grupo Rio, it's kind of nice to be able to sometimes compose things, like a break or something like that. So I'm working on some things that way. And I think it was maybe a month ago, I introduced something. And so it's still in its experimental phase, but I liked it. And I think it was pretty fun. So we're going to pursue more of that, I think, in the future. And since I've been playing congas a little bit more, I've been listening to a lot of Cuban music. And it's been 20 years since I've been in Cuba, but I'd love to go sometime again. And Yuko really wants to go. So, so we're hoping to make our way there sometime.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Jimmy, I have a question for you.
Yes.
I'm going to jump back a little bit to your group, Bloco de Sol. Every group has drama. How do you deal with drama in your group?
You know, it's funny. Our group is too young yet.
do you mean in age or as a group?
As a group. Our group is too young. So we haven't had any time for the drama to percolate or develop. But honestly, I don't really have time for it. So, you know, and I'm really lucky because our group, you know, they come and we have a good time being in each other's company and studying the music and doing our best to play it well. And we don't really have any drama, fortunately, in our group. So,
awesome.
Yeah. There's always going to be some element of that, and that creeps up, but like I said, our group is still very young. So, you know, give me another 5 years and probably have a lot of more drama, I'll tell you.
Well, it's probably a testament to you as a person too. I think the leader has a lot to do with drama in the group, and you're a solid person and you keep things light and rolling. And I mean, it's probably that as well.
In the past, my experiences in the different groups that I've been part of, I've had my moments, and I try to learn from those moments that you know, because it's not a good feeling when you, you know, lose it as a teacher, you know. I mean, it happens. You lose patience, some days it's not going to be good. You could be feeling great and going in with a big plan for what you want to teach, and then for some reason, you know, that day it's that group isn't happening, or people don't bring the right energy, or something's going on. And so I just, you know, have learned to cultivate my patience. And, you know, why get angry, you know? Mm-hmm. I've tried to learn from those experiences where, you know, I get angry or have lost my patience. Because then afterwards, then I feel terrible. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to learn, do my best to learn from that. And, you know, I have had so many amazing teachers that I've learned patience from, and how, you know, they're always patient. They're inviting. They're there to share, and it's not about, you know, I'm better than you or blah 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 or, you know, any of that. I've been around that atmosphere also, so I've learned, you know, what I don't want to be like, or I don't want to bring that type of experience around.
Right.
So, but it's really, you know, teaching is learning at the same time. So, it's a great challenge.
Jimmy, here's another question for you. When you go into, say, a new group, I mean, imagine you have a lesson plan, but do you many times just like kind of have to just drop that and just start with something else, wing it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have to be, I think, you know, you have to be very flexible. Yeah, you have to be flexible. You have to have, you know, be able to make changes on the fly, I think. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens. When I moved back from China, I had the opportunity, because I had the time, to go and hang out with some groups and teach some classes. And so I went out to Tucson, went up to Vancouver, still go up there once in a while. I went over to Alberta when there was a samba school in Calgary, and then I ended up going to southern Alberta to Lethbridge University. Mm-hmm. And sometimes your host might ask you, okay, well, we would like to work on this or something like that. And then, so you get there and you have a plan of how to approach that, and then it might change. So, yeah, you have to be prepared for that and open.
Kind of in that same respect, have you had, what is the happiest teaching moment that you've had?
Happiest teaching moment?
Mm-hmm.
There have been many.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, teaching in Taiwan, I had the opportunity to teach on an island off of the southern eastern tip of Taiwan, which is called Lanyu, or Orchid Island. The population of that island is only about 2,000 people. And it's an amazing place, And I remember teaching a group of high school kids right out by the ocean. And they were playing really well, and we were having such a great time. And that was, I'll remember that. That was a highlight. And I was there for only about 10 days, but I'll never forget that place. It was really amazing, really an amazing place. Teaching in a punk rock club in Beijing. That was really,
Two extremes, you know? Right there.
Well, yeah, because I mean, it's not like here, and people smoke like crazy in Beijing, and so you go into this punk rock club, you know, you might go in there on a Saturday or a Sunday to teach, and they might have had a big show the night before. The place still smells like smoke. But you're in there teaching, it's pretty amazing feeling, actually. But, you know, what comes out of those experiences, really, you know, great music and great memories. And then the performances, some of the performances that especially like, you know, in San Francisco, it was the Carnival and making that happen, because that's that's a tremendous amount of work. And then in China, playing, you know, we did a lot of things during the Olympics in 2008. We played on the Great Wall in 2008 during the Olympics. Taiwan, there was one parade where we put together many of the Aboriginal groups that I was teaching. They all came to Taiwan and took part in this parade. So that particular year, we must have had almost 300 drummers playing.
Wow.
And that was really something. Bryant Evangelista and Nelly Zamora were there in Taiwan at the time. And I believe Hinata was there also. Mm-hmm. And so we really had an amazing time with that parade. And that was really something. So
I think that... Yeah. Jimmy, I think you win for the best, happiest moment playing samba on the Great Wall of China. Give me a break. That's crazy.
Yeah, that was really... That was a big moment. It was at night, and it was at this amazing... They had this amazing venue set up on the Great Wall at one. It was like we were playing for a bunch of VIPs. So we were playing while all these limos were arriving. And then after we did that, then we went into the venue and played on this. It was like a amazing stage in the middle of this like big pond, fireworks going off all over the place. Supposedly Quincy Jones was there also. But we never saw him. But yeah. Oh, you guys are playing for Quincy Jones. Oh, okay, cool.
Quincy, if you're listening, let us know that you're there.
Shout out Quincy Jones.
But I mean, you know, that was really quite an amazing time being in Beijing. It's really a lot of great experiences there. And then, you know, every year to be able to have the experience of going to Brazil camp, it's like Christmas, you know, it's Christmas in August.
Yes, definitely. Like, you know, Jimmy, one of my favorite things at camp was, I think you taught the beginning bateria, and there was a lot of folks from Beijing there, and you guys did the Enheduin.
That's right.
In Mandarin?
Yeah. So some of the students from Beijing were there and took a Chinese folk song and turned it into a mini in Hey Do.
Yeah, that was
fun. That was really fun. Yeah, Bryant was playing cavaquinho. Yeah, it was really
good. Shout out to Bryant.
Yeah, brother Bryant. So, that was a highlight. I enjoyed teaching the beginning class that year. Very fun. So, but I like accompanying the classes too. And
yeah.
And I learn a lot, even just accompanying those classes. Mm. And all the amazing teachers. It's great.
Like you said, it's like Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Especially, you know, especially everyone sets up the lights and you're walking around. It's like, wow, it's Christmas here.
Literally.
I always find myself spontaneously breaking into, when I'm there, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Yeah, we we're going to break out some kind of artificial snow machine. I can't say enough about how amazing Brazil Camp has been, and how it's been responsible for so many great things in my life. So I'm really grateful to Dennis and Rich for keeping this Brazil Camp going, and for all of the really hard work that they mm-hmm. put in to make it happen, and all their efforts to bring out these amazing teachers. Really.
Yeah, we really amazing. Are spoiled. So, Jimmy, question for you. So, any suggestions? If you're going to Rio for the first time, or Salvador, anywhere, any tips for newbies to Brazil?
Any tips? Well, let's see.
Places you should go to?
Well, I mean, I've been to Brazil 4 times, so I haven't gone as often as I would like, and I certainly haven't been there as many times as many of my colleagues and a lot of the same people that we know. Mm-hmm. We have quite a network already established of people to visit and teachers to study from. But the last time I was there was it 2 or 3 years ago now? 2014. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed going to all of the summer school rehearsals and watching the technical rehearsals in the Sambadromo. That was great. So I would highly recommend that, of course. And going to all of the street rehearsals. Amazing, amazing experiences. Very powerful music fortunately for me, because being there at the same time as Georgie, we're able to go into the Tejedu and to mm-hmm. experience the Candomblé ceremony, and very beautiful and powerful experiences of the music and everything that happens in the ceremony. So I think that should be something that people should experience or to see, because it's very, this music that we study and that we were very passionate about was very deep. And so make your journey into discovering how deep you can go in, with the music and beyond the music.
Nice.
Yeah, I was listening to Jacare's episode, the podcast with Jacare, and he recommended that the place, I think it's, I can't remember the name of it, but he said it's the place that has really good frango passarinho.
Oh, is that the yellow something?
Yes, yes.
Something about yellow.
Yes, I would agree with him on that.
You'll get the chicken.
Oh man, it's the best. Yeah. And also if you get to have the frango passarinho outside of the Portela Quadra. That's mm-hmm. oh. also excellent.
Jimmy's excellent. Chicken tips here on the Brazilian Beach.
Yes. Yeah. you could do the frango passarinho tour.
Maybe that's a new trip you could start.
The chicken trip. Yeah.
I'll go on the Jimmy chicken trip.
Yeah. So.
Do you have a payment plan?
Yep. looking forward to going, hopefully, again in 2018.
Hey, I've got a question about the Ensaios Técnicos. I think that's how you say it. Is that all happen within one specific short time period, or is that kind of like spread out? Like if somebody was going to try to go see that.
Well, I believe those are ongoing, all the way up to Carnival.
For like a month,
I'm not sure.
Or like a week, or how?
Oh, I think at least that amount of time, if not,
oh,
you know,
more. Oh, okay.
I think probably starting in maybe even October or November, even that,
oh.
Even as early as that. Yeah, I don't think it's just something that happens in the few weeks up to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it goes on for a while. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In talking with Mr. Ayutin, he mentioned that by January, you know, the group has to be ready to go, and that you know, at that time, you know, in January, it's inconceivable for people to be making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So, gotta have it together. If you're gonna parade, gotta have it together.
As Mestre Jonas told us, they'll slash your drum if you're not ready.
That's right. Yeah. Great stories on the podcast. I really enjoyed listening to all of these.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I really enjoyed a lot. And, you know, Capuccio had the best ending line in his podcast.
Yeah,
you
did.
Know? Just awesome. I mean, I listened to that podcast, and when it got to the end there and he said that, you know, good music is worth fighting for. Good music is one way that humanity can redeem itself.
Right.
Man, I was just like, very powerful.
Yeah.
If you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it, folks.
Oh, I love that.
Episode six? Seven. Episode seven.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, we got to keep the music going. That, you know, in good times and in difficult times.
Yeah.
It's such a, I mean, for so many of us, it's such a big thing for us, and it's just such a connector.
Yeah, we're really lucky to be able to have the opportunity to play music, and to learn. And so, you know, that's why, like, you know, when I said I didn't have time for the drama part, I just don't.
Yeah.
Because why?
Good point.
You know, it's a not good use of time or energy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been really lucky. I think that, you know, these things kind of end up working themselves out. So, you know, over the years, there are times when there might be some folks that show up to a class or a rehearsal or whatever, and you know, the vibe is just not quite right. something's up, you know. But sure enough, you know, luckily, maybe for me, those folks never end up coming back. It's not a good fit either way, you know, on both sides.
Hmm.
So I think if you keep your intention and your feelings genuine in teaching and in playing, then that keeps everything that keeps the balance.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. So, Jimmy.
Yes.
Would you have any upcoming shows, events, workshops that you'd like to let our listeners know about?
You know, it's funny. I don't have anything coming up. I mean, Yuko and I are going to start up our classes again in the new year, and we're looking forward to that. And so we teach every Saturday at the Mexican Heritage Plaza in San Jose, and Yuko has her Wednesday night dance class in downtown San Jose, in San Jose's Japantown, at this dance studio called the Get Down.
Get Down.
Yeah. So she's teaching her Wednesday night class, and yeah, I have, you know, I'm enjoying my break, and then I start up my work in the schools next week. And I have, you know, I'll have some gigs pop up here and there. I usually play twice a week, or twice a month rather, on Saturdays with a group here in Mountain View, California, and it's a fun group. Latin music group.
And where do you play at?
It's at this restaurant called the Cascal, and it's like a tapas place, beautiful bar, and it's a it's very fun music. It's two guitars and a bass, and me playing like a pair of congas and half of a drum set.
And which half?
the good half. Okay. Yeah, it's kind of a crazy setup, but I really enjoyed it. It's challenging. So I have a kick drum, a snare drum, a hi-hat, and a pair of timbales and a pair of congas. And mash it all together and see what comes out.
Cool. But,
very fun. Very fun.
And that's in San Jose, you said?
It's in
Mountain View. Mountain View.
Town called Mountain View. Mountain View, California.
Okay. So, if you're in Mountain View.
Yeah. That's where, right near Google.
I was going to say, there's a giant Google sign.
Yes.
Turn left at the Google.
Yes. The city of Google.
So those are your workshops and events. You'll be at California Brazil Camp this summer, as always.
Yes. Both weeks.
Very good. Yeah,
It's hard for me to think about going to, I could never see myself going 1 week, I mean, Brazil Camp used to be just 1 week, but then
when
it went to 2 weeks, I just kept going to both weeks. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed a lot and looking forward to the 20th anniversary.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. So excited. And so we'll see you there. And then you'll also be helping Mestre Jorge for the San Francisco Carnival?
Yes. I'll be helping Jorge with Grupo Hio, Grupo Samba Hio. And, yeah. I keep wanting to go to Jacare's Carnival every year, but somehow or another it never happens. And so never know. I might try to make it this year. We'll see.
And Rich is going to be playing at that gig.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with Dandara.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, this year and last year after camp, I went to San Diego to play with the folks there in San Diego. Yeah, with Mestre Ailton and Amy and the folks there for the San Diego Brazil Day, and get a chance to visit Hinata. It's great fun.
That's quite an event to put on.
Oh man, it was awesome. And Carlinhos Brown was there this year. So
Sheesh.
Yeah, it's right out there by the beach. Man, it was the best. Very fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
And any shout outs, Jimmy? Any drum or percussion
companies?
Am I supposed to say Bola like Percussion again? Bola Percussion.
Man, what are your favorite? What are your favorite Bola instruments that you have?
Let's see. I have several of his.
He's got it written
bells.
Down. I can hear the pages.
No, I have several of his bells. Let's see. I've got the pocket shaker.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Try
the pocket shaker. I have played his pandeiros, but I don't actually own one.
Mm-hmm.
But I borrowed some from him from time to time. I recently borrowed the triangulo that he makes.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
That he makes he makes them out of rebar, and they look so like menacing when you're holding it. But they sound great.
Triangle sound or great. Street fighting instrument.
Yes. Yeah. When you're going to play those heavy metal.
You need one of those for the punk bar in Beijing.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. So I would just shout out to, all the folks in our Brazil Camp family and all of our teachers who we miss dearly. Some that come, every year, every other year, or maybe those that we haven't seen for a while that hopefully we'll see again at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And just all respect and thanks to all the teachers, the dance teachers, percussion teachers, and for everything that they've given us all and for what they share. and just for what we learn from them in class and outside of class as well.
Totally.
Very, many, many important lessons. I think Dennis was saying that in his podcast that, you know, a lot of this is about, you know, learning but hanging out, you know. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, something like
being
that.
Being able to hang out with your heroes, your teachers, and people you really respect.
Yeah, being able to hang out, you know, making the time. And so that's why, again, you know, with the camp, that's what's so great about it, because it is like Christmas. You're there with your family, you know, with your percussion and dance family, and make new
and you're
friends.
Not going anywhere. Yeah, you spend 24 hours together. It's
seven for
you know, not 7 days a week, but for however amount of time you're there.
Yeah. Very fun. I think the first 2 or 3 years I went to camp, I actually couldn't fathom the idea of camping, actually. Like, I just never enjoyed camping. You know, to me, outdoors is where the car is parked. So I actually stayed in Monte Rio the first, I think.
Oh,
the first,
you did?
Oh, really?
Yeah, the first 2 or 3 years, I just said, nope, I'm staying in Monte Rio. So I stayed there. And then I think the camp was just a week. So I would stay there the week. And finally, Brian and Nelly, they said, dude, you just try it. Just try it, you know? So I think that first year we stayed in one of the platform tents, and it was the three of us. Can you imagine?
Oh, my God. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, we caused a lot of trouble on the so-called quiet side of camp.
I stayed that on that side once.
I stay on that back. Side. That's my side. I like sleeping.
Well, thank you guys for having me, and thanks for the folks that would actually take the time to listen.
Oh man, Jimmy, thank you for coming on.
We weren't that scary, were we?
No. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Oh, hey, we have a new sponsor, Bola Percussion.
That's right. Bola.
Thanks, Bola. Marco Mallets, you want to
join in?
Marco Mallets.
CBC Contemporanea.
Yeah.
Equipment.
The list is long.
Yes.
Yamaha drums.
Yeah.
Right? I think they provide the drum sets or something like that.
Oh, we'll take money from anybody.
Meinl. Yeah. Rhythm Traders here in Portland.
Rhythm Traders. I got to get up there to see that store. I've always heard about that store, but
you got to
also
visit.
There's a really cool there's a great drum set store up there too called the I think it's Revival.
Revival.
Very dangerous.
So Jimmy, there you go. You got to come up here. You got to come visit us.
Portland.
So Jimmy, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you and getting to hear all these stories.
Thank you. My pleasure. Very fun.
Awesome interview with Jimmy. If someone out there is really good with finding YouTube videos of Jimmy with blue hair, split screen WrestleMania in the early 90s, mid 90s, please find that and send it to us.
Or just pictures of Jimmy with blue hair. We'd love to see that.
Yeah.
Love it.
Jimmy's family and friends, if you're listening,
please send that our way. So this week we'd like to give a couple shout outs. One to Eric Crawford, photographer extraordinaire. He's the camp photographer at California Brazil Camp. Takes awesome pictures. You can find him on Flickr. And he's just been really helpful and has some awesome photos that we've been able to use for this podcast. So a big, big shout out to Eric. Also, we'd like to give a shout out to Cherish in Austin. She's been listening to our podcasts, and thanks so much for listening, Cherish. And then I have one more shout out. I have a shout out to my partner in crime, Courtney, who, yes, you. About a year ago, she approached me about this idea of doing a little podcast. And so it kind of all started last winter. We started talking about it, planning it, thinking of names. It took a while, but we finally made it here on the airwaves. So shout out to Courtney. Woohoo!
Yay!
Oh,
thanks. Yeah, I was really happy that you agreed to do it because I was like, I don't know anybody, but I really want to do this. But Diana knows everybody and she's super organized. Yeah, this has been really good. Thank you.
So we'll have a big celebratory podcast or something, or a beer on our actual year of the first podcast.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So we would love to get your audio and feature it on the podcast of your group. So if you guys have good quality audio from your samba group or your maracatu group or your whole group or whatever it is, please send it to us. You can send it to thebrazilianbeat@gmail.com. You can also find us at www.thebrazilianbeat.com. We have photos there. You can stream all the podcasts from there, see photos of our guests, and see some photos from Brazil Camp and other places. We also have some resources there, different things. You just explore around. We're also, you can find us on Twitter, BrazilianBeat1. That's the number one. We're on Facebook, The Brazilian Beat, Instagram, The Brazilian Beat, and you can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Google Play, Player FM, and as I said before, you can stream us through our website. Also, please rate us on iTunes. You go into iTunes and you click on The Brazilian Beat and there's a little star rating and then you can write a description if you want to. So,
besides our only other one review, so we'd love to see more.
Yeah, let us know what you think. Okay, thanks.
Ciao.